Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome back to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Welcome back seems appropriate. It's been about a month since we've had an episode. We know we say we're going to get more consistent, and then life crops up and we don't do it. But it's not that we don't care and that we don't try, but happy to be joined tonight. This is sort of a flashback thing. I just have Chris Coppola. We don't have the rest of the team because of various reasons. But Chris, it seems appropriate that I would suggest that you say hi to the good people.
Hi, good people.
There we go. Now it's officially A Fork in Time. And just to give you a little bit of the background here, I'm going to turn it over to Chris to set up our fork. But just so you know, we were actually planning to do a different episode tonight, and then again, the change in who was able to join for the team. And so the person who suggested the topic can't be here. We sort of have a standing rule that if it's your topic you suggest, you ought to be on your own episode that you suggested the topic for. So that's why we're departing here. But that led us to speculate the last minute, what could we do and not steal topics that we know we have lined up for others who couldn't be here tonight? And so, Chris, you have suggested something that we were talking off podcast seems incredibly timely and also connects to the episode that we were going to have. So it works both ways from that. So now that I've teased our audience with that, I'll hand it over to you to pick it up from there.
So most of you know that I'm a little bit of a bomb thrower on the episodes, and I will have an idea that I'm going to link into it somehow. And this was one of those. This whole episode started as an idea that I was going to somehow try and work in to the bigger, the original episode. The original episode was going to be what happened if Gerald Ford did not pardon Nixon for Watergate. And we're literally talking today is the day that, it's a multi-day hearing, I believe, right?
Today was the Supreme Court hearing, the oral arguments, U.S. Okay. Supreme Court on the case being made for Trump to have blanket immunity. So I was sharing with Chris, I actually got a chance between other things that I was doing at work to, now that they stream the oral arguments live, it's like, I actually could listen to this while I'm doing some other stuff. And so I heard about half of that. So also I heard Richard Nixon's name a lot today. I heard Gerald Ford's name a lot today because of that.
So we're going to get to that one. I promise.
That is Eric Bond's suggested episode. Mm-hmm. Eric couldn't join us tonight. So we are shout out to Eric. I know you had something come up last minute. We are saving that for you because not only that, but Eric did his nice as he always does background notes for us. We have all of those.
So I said, and we discussed, if you look at all the criming that Richard Nixon did, getting him for Watergate was a little bit like getting Al Capone for tax evasion. So today we're talking about what I personally consider like the RICO, the murder, the top level, the stuff that he actually did that is just like really, really bad. Not exactly as popularly known about. But once you hear it out, might be worse than a couple of people trying to break in and steal some paperwork. So where we're going back to is Richard Nixon's first election in 1968. And so just trying to think about how to set this up. Let's start with the Tet Offensive at the beginning of 1968, January, February, there's a surprise attack. The South Vietnamese communists with North Vietnamese support try and set off a massive national rising against the South Vietnamese government. It fails and succeeds at the exact same time. It fails in the sense that by about 2 months later, the entire structure of the NLF, National Liberation Front, South Vietnamese Communists, Viet Cong, all these different names, is wiped out because they came out and they actually fought like a good old fashioned battle. And they got blown up doing it. But the other part of that is, for all of us who grew up watching Full Metal Jacket, even Walter Cronkite says the war is unwinnable because in that offensive, they attacked the American embassy. They took over most cities. They showed a level of activity that the United States did not expect, or at least the American public did not expect. We have been told again and again that there's light at the end of the tunnel, that just a little bit more, we're almost there. And now they're taking over entire cities. And it just shocked the United States. And I think most people looking back at this say this was the event that the American public turned and said, we want out. We're not going to win this. So let's start thinking about how do we get out of it. Right after that, LBJ goes on national television and says he is not going to run for president. LBJ took over after Kennedy's assassination. He took over late enough in that term that the 64 election was his own in his own right. But because he did not serve as president long enough under, and we talked about, you know, the constitutional amendment in relation to the Eisenhower and everything, he hadn't served long enough in the joint Kennedy Johnson in that term that he could have run in 68. And the big suggestion was that he was going to. Everybody assumed he was.
Yeah, he would not be violating or even seeking to violate the 22nd Amendment, which was already in place because he was less than half of the first term. So he could have almost hit that magic place of almost the maximum amount of presidency you can get post the passage of the 22nd Amendment.
And the other part of it, in echoes of today's election, there's going to be so many echoes of today, but this is the first one. Biden wasn't on the New Hampshire ballot. He had to run a write-in campaign there. Johnson wasn't on the New Hampshire ballot because he, you know, was still questioning it. It had already happened when he made the speech. And a lot of people suggest that the success of Eugene McCarthy in New Hampshire showed Johnson this was going to be a harder fight and kind of convinced him to step out. Right. I promise I'm going to try and jump along to some stuff now. Hey, we got an RFK involved in this election, too. Steps up. He starts running. It's assassinated June when he has finally won the California primary. He, you know, and we talked about this off podcast. This was the last convention season that mattered. And partly because this convention season went so horribly. This was the last convention where you had a lot of machine politicians, a lot of state parties deciding who the delegates were. After this, it goes to primaries. And I mean, we are sitting here in April and the two parties have already decided. Have you voted yet? Has your primary happened yet, John?
Yep. We were Super Tuesday this year, okay. So we voted early and often, as we often do here in Texas.
Yeah, mine hasn't, but I already know who the two nominees for my president are going to be because of the primary system and the way it works now. But in 1968, and especially because you had such a, I'm going to say, bifurcated party structure. Like I mentioned, Eugene McCarthy, as an anti-war candidate, had votes out of New Hampshire. Once RFK Sr. gets involved, he starts picking up delegates. Hubert Humphrey is running as basically the Johnson stand-in. So he's winning a lot of the establishment support. But going into the convention, nobody knew how it was going to shake out. we're going to go ahead and skip the Chicago convention this time. And Hubert Humphrey won the Democratic nomination out of this convention and is challenging Richard Nixon, former VP, all of this. Okay. Here we get to the criming. John, you know, I talked about the United States in, after Tet in the spring starts thinking, you know what, we're not going to be able to win. And Johnson says, we're going to start to go. By the way, he had tried to negotiate all along, but after the defeat of the NLF, after the defeat of the Tet Offensive, there are actually the North Vietnamese open up and are willing to discuss some sort of an agreement with the United States. The United States is there supporting the South Vietnamese government, the Republic of Vietnam, and obviously has to get them to agree to whatever deal is going to happen. Richard Nixon uses some back channel communications to communicate with the Republic of Vietnam government and say, don't negotiate. Do not go to these meetings, because if you hold out, anybody hear the border bill here? Don't solve this issue until I get elected. I will solve this election so much better for you.
I want this fixed, but I need to be the fixer, right? It sort of is. Yeah.
Here's the only problem. Here's the one thing. Okay. You can say what you will about the modern equivalency. The United States has troops in Vietnam. They are dying. Every American soldier that died between basically 69 and our withdrawal might have been saved if Richard Nixon doesn't play politics with the national security of the United States. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's a fair statement. And again, there, in fact, I already know what the title of this episode is going to be, Chris. It's going to be Echoes, 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 because there's a lot of them here. There's similar arguments that can be made, not quite the same way, because there's an active shooting war where American GIs, and other military personnel are exposed. But, the same argument can be made for some of the dealings around the 80 election and what's going on with the Iran hostage situation and this idea. In fact, eventually what we're going to get to here, which is this idea of the fact that diplomacy is supposed to be practiced in this country by the president.
Diplomats
under the direction of the president and our diplomatic apparatus. It's not supposed to be private citizens engaging in foreign diplomacy. And there's even there's this thing called the Logan Act that sort of talks about that.
So here's the point is, what we're building up to is this. This is still the Hoover FBI. And I wish I knew which party Hoover was. He played for Republicans. He played for Democrats. Hoover was a Hooverite.
I was fixing to say he was the Hoover party.
And they were wiretapping Chenault, Anna Chenault, who, was the wife of the guy who did the Flying Tigers and is very pro Republic of China, has very close ties to the Republic of Vietnam, very anti-communist. They're wiretapping her because she is using basically her condo down in Foggy Bottom, which is, if you know DC at all, not far from where the actual diplomats are, but she's not one of them.
Right.
And they're wiretapping her because they think she might be involved with trying to scuttle these negotiations. And they pick up phone conversations between her and Richard Nixon. And they have Nixon on tape telling her, hey, try and stop these negotiations. Tell them if they hold out, they will get a better deal under me.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing that's happened in that, you know, you talked about, I guess you talked about who are there when Johnson decides not to run. You know, there's an argument there that he is going to be challenged. McGovern has already chosen to do that, right? McCarthy. I'm sorry. McCarthy is 68. McGovern is later. Yep. So McCarthy has already chosen to challenge. But the presumption is probably that because it's still the type of convention that you're talking about, the sitting U.S. president probably can get the nomination, even if he can't win the election, the general election, he probably can still get the nomination, right? It's very rare to not have the sitting U.S. president of a particular party be the nominee. There will be challenges. There's other echoes of this, C-1980, that I've already alluded to being one of those examples. But the assumption is there. Robert F. Kennedy doesn't get involved until Johnson says, I'm not running. So it's a late push that's going on there that also happens. And so this chaos that's the Democratic Party and its presidential situation in 68 is a function of, as you've already mentioned, Tet, what's been escalating up to that point, Johnson's announcement that he's choosing. In fact, you know, the famous thing is, I will not seek nor accept, you know, so I'm not asking for it and I won't take it if you give it to me. Although we talked a little bit off podcast, maybe he's going, well, if you ask me to, maybe I will. But, and then, so Kennedy comes into play, what's going on here. So this sets up, particularly after Kennedy's assassination in the middle of 68 was a wacky year. Yeah. It happens to be the year of my birth. It was a wacky year. What ends up happening here is Nixon rolls, you know, in the fall. But if this comes out, and the timing on this would have been October-ish, right?
The conversations with that LBJ is on tape, you know, discussing this are in October. So the important thing is Humphrey's the nominee. This is after the convention, so the nominees are locked in. This is a Humphrey Nixon fight. George Wallace gets involved and wins, you know, probably the second most successful third party run ever. But this is a Humphrey Nixon fight.
Right. And so, again, we're an alternate history podcast. We did a lot of the setup here because we had to do a lot of the setup, and for good reason. So our departure point, the fork, is this idea that instead of it being something that, you know, stays out of the public light for years and years and years till after other things have come along with Nixon and, you know, we are embroiled in Watergate and everything else. Somehow either the actual audio recording of these tapes or the very existence of these tapes gets out. So Chris, how are we nominating for our fork here that this becomes public? How does it become public?
Johnson does it. He holds a press conference and he announces it. This does a couple of things. First, I mean, this was a 0.7% national election.
Right.
With a third party candidate in there. Both candidates, both sides are saying, we want peace. Nixon says he's got his plan for peace, and both sides are saying they want peace. I think Johnson comes out and says, listen, this is a matter of national security. We cannot allow this kind of activity. Getting back to the echoes of things, by the way, Richard Nixon is a private citizen at this point. Right. Anything he does, he has no immunities for. So there's not even an argument that he should not be. I mean, there's an argument about the you know, whether this is a violation of the Logan Act, but there's no immunity argument in this case. Yeah. And I think if that comes out, you see several states flip and you see Humphrey win. And the other part of it is this. Nixon, I think, told the South Vietnamese, we'll back you, we'll support you, all these, you know, we'll prop you up and all these other things. Once becomes very clear, you know, looking past November, once becomes clear that Nixon is not going to win, well, now the South Vietnamese government is a little more inclined to actually pay attention and attend the talks.
Right. And so let me just make sure I can, if I can summarize, I say this all the time in my business context. If I can repeat it back to you and get it right, normally that means I've understood it properly. So you would argue, Chris, in this alternate timeline where this becomes public relatively close to the election, it's a fairly substantial, it's going to be a national story. It's going to be a scandalous story in a close election that's already got lots of other moving parts going on, that we end up with a Humphrey presidency.
Absolutely.
And we have probably Richard Nixon at least disgraced publicly, so much so that it'd be very difficult for him to rehabilitate in the near term and be a candidate for office, or more likely is actually prosecuted for the offense here, right?
I don't want to say he's publicly humiliated, primarily because of his reaction to losing the California gubernatorial election in 1962. He already was publicly humiliated, and he got so petulant. He has this famous quote of, you're not going to have Nixon to kick around anymore, so I'm going to, he didn't actually say this, but he basically says, I'm going to take my ball and go home.
Right.
So he's already got several, he lost in 60. He lost in 62. He already has several kind of embarrassing losses. This is criminal. This is beyond embarrassing.
And during a time when there would have been other, eventually we will see this because the way that things play out, eventually there's going to be the rise of, of Reagan. There's going to be the others that come along that pick up the Republican banner in subsequent decades, now we're in the side of the what ifs, do those people come along earlier? Does someone else rise to prominence? Because my point on all of these things, and we've touched on this topic before around, Watergate is one of the big rocks in the pond where the ripples are immediate, but then the ripples really grow long term because of that disruption and what it did. We will come back to Eric's topic of, what happens if Ford doesn't, pardon, because that has ripples as well in theory. Is Ford in a position where maybe he has a chance to win in 76 under different circumstances, whatever the case might be? But where I'm going here with this, what I would argue is no Nixon election in 68. The things that eventually become the scandal that we know, which is, I guess, to borrow your verb with an ing, the minor crimen, now I'm dropping off the G with my Texan accent, the minor criming of Watergate doesn't happen because the major criming has already come to light.
Well, yeah, he's not around to crime in the next election. He's probably incarcerated.
Yeah. And so, again, now you have a Democrat winning the election in 68. So what does that, one of the places I'm going to ask here, because we didn't talk about this off podcast, I don't know where you go, what does that set up, assuming that they're able to come to the conclusion of peace between 68 and 72, the war comes to an end. Mm-hmm. So Humphrey's able to take credit for that. Johnson's legacy is improved a little bit because it's not, the carryover thing that comes from that. So then we roll up to 72, now with 12 years of Democrats controlling the White House. We know American politics well enough to know that the pendulum swings. And so, does it swing back? And what issue would it swing back on becomes the question at that point, because the other thing that impacts the 72 election is also the fact that, there's still things going on that relate to Vietnam.
No, we're still in Vietnam.
Right. It's still an issue.
Yeah. I think, you're talking about what's going to happen to the Republican Party. Do they swing back to the Reagan right? I think that happens. I'm thinking drawing a very clear line back to Goldwater in 68. I think they see that. I think they see the success of George Wallace in 68. And Nixon did this. Nixon saw the success of Wallace in 68 and saw the ability, you know, the famous Southern strategy.
Right.
And I think a Reagan is able to come in. You know, if anything, I'd liken this to the 92 election, where on paper, you've got a winning president, somewhat popular, but there's just, you know, it's nobody can sustain more than 12 years in power, period. And I think the maybe not full Birch Republican, but the more socially conservative, the more moral majority Republicans can succeed there because the business Republicans, the Romneys, the Rockefellers were a little too close to Nixon. And they're just, you know, they're tarred in a way that kind of rock ribbed. Well, gee, we should have just, you know, we should have nuked Hanoi. We shouldn't be playing around with them. I think those kind of Republicans come to the fore earlier than they were able to in our timeline.
Okay. So do you think under that scenario, whoever the nominee might be, the first place I go is Reagan, but it could be somebody else in that ilk, obviously, mm-hmm. that would have been out there. My first blush is, again, the, like you said, the problem of, you know, 12 years is about the maximum that it sustains. There's probably going to be Republican candidate unknown. I'm calling Republican candidate X here, mm-hmm. probably prevails in 72. And there's a different set of domestic and international issues that are at play as a result of the Vietnam War coming to an earlier conclusion.
Yeah, the other part of it is, the economy is starting to slow by 72. Nixon completely ends the gold standard. All of these things, you know, setting up kind of a 92 style election. And I think he's around. I think this is a Reagan presidency in 73-72 election.
So again, Republicans taking the White House in 73, not even trying to figure out how Congress is going to fall in this, but you know that also that element that's there. So no Watergate, mm-hmm. no, by the way, no Spiro Agnew, by the way. So no Ford moving at least forward as prominent in the way that he did there because mm-hmm. of taking over the vice presidency, no Watergate, no things that set up for the outsider that Carter represents and a swing back to the other party. So again, these are those But talk about when you pull Watergate, however you pull Watergate out of the equation, a lot of these other ripples that we know either go away or they're altered in how they move across the pond, right?
I would say this. I think this is big. I think that, you know, people talk about Watergate as the end of the 60s, the end of trust in authority. And I think this may be that. May have a lot of the similar effects as a Watergate did just earlier. I don't necessarily think moving it earlier it matters much. I just think that the 60s were very much distrusting of institutions or starting a subversion of institutions. And Watergate was coming out and saying, I mean, people had trouble believing a president could do these things. I think this has a similar effect of people taking a step back and reevaluating the trust in institutions they have.
Okay. Maybe not as abrupt as Watergate was, but the theme was already, the seed has already been planted. It just, it flowers mm-hmm. in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Let's just assume for argument's sake here, just to make it simple, too. It's Reagan in 72 becomes president in 73. Mm-hmm. Probably sets up well for a re-election, successful re-election, barring the economy. Again, mm-hmm. echoes here. It's the economy, stupid.
Yep.
You know, comes back. But so barring that, so we have Republicans holding the White House until 80, give or take. And now, now you have this next generation of whatever is going to come along. To your point, you know, maybe is that a time that a Carter-esque figure arises, or, you know, now maybe it's, you know, we don't know if Chappaquiddick still happens, I guess, in this scenario. So is there a Ted Kennedy coming along?
No, I think it is. I think it's Ted. I think Ted Kennedy does come along. He doesn't have the competition he does in our timeline. And it's a natural point for him to step up. You know, he's got the family name, and I think he runs. And I think he would win. And I think we're skipping over the mid-70s too much. I think the oil shocks, I think Carter's behavior, Reagan's behavior in at the end of 73 during the Yom Kippur War. I think thinking about the nuclear talks that happened, thinking about Angola, thinking about all of these places all over the world, I'm not convinced that it's not Ted Kennedy in 76. I think this may be an no political party survives more than 12 years, but man, the Democrats have been in power for a while.
Right.
And if it's a Reagan coming in, the kind of shock that he was or wants to be, then you have an oil shock almost immediately. Then you have all of the economic, you know, fallout from that. I don't know if you don't have, you can't do more than 12 years, but you got one term, you hand it right back.
Yeah, there's precedent for that. Obviously, historically, it's not as prominent, but it's certainly there. And again, just a different, anytime we talk Watergate, and again, we've talked about this on a number of episodes, it's the same thing I've said before. It's hard to imagine the timeline without it that way, because it's just such a part of the timeline we know that it's hard. You know, there's so many of the moving pieces that are blocked or impacted by that when you pull it out of the way, it's like, what does this do? Well, those other things are still there. They just interact in different ways, and maybe the same ways just manifest themselves differently.
And I'll go ahead and say this. Maybe there is a Carter on a ticket in 76. I mean, if you look at the traditional balancing act they did in 60, you have
Kennedy Carter.
Yeah, Kennedy Carter.
What? Wow. Well, I was even thinking forward to, again, you're right. You know, the shock of, you know, the first oil crisis in the early 70s, how that's responded to by a Reagan or a Reagan-esque figure that's in the thing there. You know, the fact that, you know, for example, one of the things that we're, again, echoes to today, you know, we're dealing with a very different situation in the Middle East to a degree because of Camp David, still echoing forward from that, you know. Camp David happens under the Carter watch for the reasons that it does, although there's reasons for Egypt to want to do what Egypt wants to do. But, you know, is there a different take from Israel even during that period of time, if there is the reelected Reagan-esque, you know, that's there, you know, again, echoes where we are today in terms of the foreign policy aspects of that post the OPEC crisis, post 73 Yom Kippur, you know, what's going on there, you know, with, you know, eventually Sadat's assassination, all the things that happened down, you know, all the things that happened there, because I think it's reasonable to argue that Sadat is assassinated because he had the willingness to do what he did at Camp David. So if you don't have a Camp David, does that change how Egypt plays out? I don't know. There's a lot. I think the ripple.
I think Camp David happens. Not to get too into, you know, esoteric things that I kind of have a stake in or some feelings about, Israeli politics after 1973, you had the founders voted out. right. completely. You had, since the founding, you had secular, basically social democratic parties that had held power almost, and you know, they rotated between each other. With the defeat, with the almost defeat, or with the results of 73, with the fact that they were caught so off guard, they were gone. They were voted out completely. Echoes of what's about to happen the next time Netanyahu gets around to holding an election. Right. I think the right-wing, more religious parties got caught with their pants down themselves. And there's going to be a, you know, complete reshift of their politics. But I think Sadat came in, and everything I've read, everything I've seen says Sadat did not want to attack in 73. He felt we had to do something to prove that we can actually stand up and fight. We're not going to just get smashed anytime we do anything. And then I'm going to be able to move forward. And so, the United States doesn't get to dictate everything that happens. Sometimes it's what's going on in these internal countries. And I don't think there's any way to, you know, I don't think the United States would have wanted to, but I think it's internal developments in Egypt more than Israel. I think both sides in Israel wanted peace. It's the developments in Egypt that allowed it. Right. As long as you actually have somebody, okay. Jeez, we really try to avoid this, but I'm going to go ahead and step over the line here. As long as you have somebody else on the other side that actually wants to stop killing you, finding peace can be kind of easy.
Yeah, if both parties have, even for different reasons, a motivation to end it, it will tend to end because of what happens if it doesn't. Agreed. But one of the things that popped into my head there, the other place I went is, you know, again, partly because we put Reagan in this, moving Reagan forward. Of course, mm-hmm. he runs in 76, you know, so it's not moving him that far forward mm-hmm. to assume that he's there in 72. And he's, you know, he's got the California thing going, all the things that are happening there. Still the Cold War. What's going on? What, you know, and sometimes turning hot in other ways during this period of time, like it has, you know, Vietnam being the latest example of that. But otherwise, so is there a big change in U.S.-Soviet relations as a result of this? And or here's the other thing I'll throw in there, Chris, you know, what is Nixon known for in terms of the other major communist power, which is China, right?
I think a Reagan can open China in a way that a Humphrey can't. And I think that would be an amazing accomplishment of his. I honestly believe he would have had to have a Kissinger hold his hand to get there. I don't think Reagan had the, you know, Kissinger and Nixon were a political team. Kissinger understood international politics. Nixon understood balance of power. He understood it in a way that I just, you know, don't see a Reagan doing it. I see a Reagan being able to. And I think there were enough smart people, you know, especially with the friction of the Vietnam War removed. And by the way, with this giant cloud over American relations with the Republic of China, with Taiwan, I think a Reagan could have opened China. I think that happens with the behind the scenes importance of all of those people, you know, H.W. Bush, Kissinger, all of the people on the Republican side that are foreign policy and strong, you know, American Cold Warriors.
Yeah. So does anything change with the Soviet equation there?
I think it's a real interesting time. It's because this is when Brezhnev and the Soviet mindset is saying, well, this is when they expect to. This is almost a Wile E. Coyote moment of theirs. They've been growing and growing and matching the United States. And gee, the United States just had this massive failure and they think they're going to keep going. And this is the time when they start stagnating. This is the time when the Brezhnev, like, you know, your childhood, like, view of the Soviet Union was these old people just dying off. These geriatric, like, yep, Stalin survivors in a system that is just falling apart. And this is when the dynamism of a Khrushchev really starts dropping off, when you really start seeing them start falling behind.
Yeah, the succession of, you know, Brezhnev, Andropov, Chernenko, you know, it's, mm-hmm, you know,
yeah,
you're running out of old guys who have those bona fides, you know, to fill the role. You just run out of them, which is why, mm-hmm, Gorbachev rises eventually.
Yeah, and, you know, eventually in the United States, we're going to have a Gen X president. But I think the you know, I don't know if Reagan, I think Reagan, when he comes along in 1980, is pretty well placed, because I don't want this malaise, this rot has really taken effect in the Soviet Union. I don't know if his insight that we can just outspend them, we can just throw money into military projects and just scare them into spending money that they should be spending on toasters. Right. I don't know if they've really stagnated to this point where it's going to have the effect of just causing them to run the wheels off it. I think it is an interesting point in the third world. We've talked on a lot of the big places, but this is the end of colonialism. This is the end of, you know, wars of national liberation. This is kind of a place where there's not that outlet that there was throughout the 60s in all of these other places where it was safe to play. I think the other part of it is there's an argument to be made, and I don't know that Reagan is really the best to do it. Maybe Kennedy is. The Helsinki Accords in 75. And the rise of civil and human rights as an international issue and the effect that that has behind the Iron Curtain. That's a really important outgrowth that isn't there yet. I think it would be interesting to think about if you have an American president making that argument close to the Prague Spring, when that is still in a lot of people's memories, maybe that can kind of take off the way it eventually did.
Yeah, my first thinking there is, does it accelerate the events that I primarily think of being the decline of Soviet Union, ultimately, you know, the Warsaw Pact, and, you know, basically, you know, what eventually leads to what happens in Poland. And then, mm-hmm, what eventually happens, obviously, with the Berlin Wall, the other things there, you know, is there, my first blush reaction in my head was, under that scenario, maybe it gets accelerated a little bit. I don't know by how much, and I don't, mm-hmm, know how much of a difference that acceleration makes at the end of the day. But, you know, my take on the end of at least that phase of the Cold War, we argue, I guess we're in a different version of it now to a great degree, but the Soviet phase of the Cold War that had a little interregnum break and now we're back to it. I've come to think of that in my head the way I think about World War One and World War II. Well, it's the same thing. We just had a little break in the middle, you know, kind of deal. Is, you know, I don't think accelerating that makes that much of a difference, mm-hmm, globally in the big picture. It probably does make a difference in some smaller pictures that are really important and how that may play together. You know, it's, you know, again, part of it is the difference that exists between you and I in age is I remember the 70s, well. I remember not knowing what Watergate necessarily was, but seeing the things on TV every night. I certainly remember the late 70s very well. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. I remember one of my landmark events is I remember Camp David, primarily because they interrupted the premiere of the original Battlestar Galactica that Sunday night for coverage on this, and that had been hyped all summer. And so I was upset as a 10-year-old about, they had interrupted my sci-fi thing. And yeah, I knew that was important, but forget that. I can't go watch something else. But also then thinking about, I remember, the like Lenza, the Solidarity movement in Poland. And of course, I eventually remember, Reagan's presidency in the 80s and then sliding towards, the Gorbachev's rise, the end of the Cold War. By the way, we're coming back to an episode here soon on Sheep Suffrage Part 2 that'll talk more about that special thing around Thatcher, because we've had a lot of folks in our Discord channel chime in on that. We want to come back and revisit it. So again, I go down that whole path to say, again, that's more than what did happen. I don't know how much of this changes or accelerates that. And even if it does accelerate that, what difference it really makes in the long term.
I think Poland becomes important. Poland is always important. But thinking about the 76 election, which we're going to get to, and I'll bring it up again then, Ford's gaffe about saying that Poland wasn't an occupied country or under the Soviet heel, and thinking about what happens with the martial law in 1980, I mean, there's a lot. The Soviet and the Polish government clamped down on a lot of stuff, and there's a distinct argument to be made that if they're not doing that, Lech Walesa is a household name in the United States 10 years before, because all of those things were moving before the martial law regime came in and tried to put a top on that pressure cooker.
Yeah. And the other thing that just popped into my head was that I sort of skipped over there, but was certainly there because of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 79. My parallel there, it may be an oversimplistic way to think about it. My parallel is that, Afghanistan is the Soviet Vietnam, right? In so many ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if you accelerate the end of America's Vietnam, where does the Soviet, does something change about that? Does something about the broad politics there? Maybe the geopolitical situation in the Middle East is altered in such a way that you don't feel as inclined to prop up the Shah in Iran because of something else. And so you don't have the swing back there as dramatic as it is.
The one thing I think you see is because of the United States kind of not letting the tail wag the dog. That's the big thing.
Right.
You're going to see a change in the Soviet relationship with Egypt. I think Egypt breaks away quicker, which would, lead to an earlier Camp David, because the United States is sitting there willing to, give you whatever you want as long as you'll sign a peace treaty. I think it also changes the United States' view of the Shah. And especially Kennedy, if we go to that, a Kennedy reaction to looking at the Shah and saying, hey, listen, man, this guy is just not popular. And I know what my brother did, and he really got us in trouble. So maybe I need to soften that landing for him and transition that into some other kind of government that is friendly to the United States, but not necessarily tolerant.
Right. And again, this is one of the things I love about what we do here. And part of the reason I find this fascinating is that, if somebody just announces that I have some tapes, but by the way, tapes again, echoes, here's echoes mm-hmm. again, right? Mm-hmm. Watergate had tapes. Mm-hmm. The Chenault affair has tapes. They're just different kind of tapes, right?
And wiretaps of presidential candidates,
right? Is use the word ripples mm-hmm. here far too much. I think if we were a drinking game, a lot of folks would be intoxicated by now if they were using ripples as the key word mm-hmm. during this episode. But these echoes keep popping up because they keep popping up, and there's
either that or using Ford as a drinking game during the Supreme Court argument.
Let's just say I heard the name Nixon more than I heard the name Trump, at least in the part that I listened to today, because of the precedents that were being cited, you know, related to that. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. I'm glad you suggested this, Chris, because I hadn't really, you know, I was aware of this. Mm-hmm. I was aware of this, but hadn't really thought about it as a, sometimes it's the minor roads that become the major roads that suddenly change the landscape of how you travel. Right.
And when you, you know, this is one of those, what I, you know, this is kind of what I love. This is one of those things that an average American with a, you know, decent understanding of history would have at best, you know, whispers of this kind of thing. But when you know about it, gee, how big can it get?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you raised that, Chris, because one of the things I was talking to somebody, you know, off podcast and vaguely, actually it's a coworker who's vaguely familiar with the show, is along those lines of, you know, how do you guys come up, how do you come up with topics? Well, we get good suggestions, by the way. This is the plug for, again, this was Eric's topic tonight. We have a lot of topics in the queue that we will get to for our listeners. And so keep sending them, keep putting them in, you know, but you, one of the things I remember, you know, sometimes we struggle, what are we going to record on tonight? It's not because there aren't topics. It's that we have sort of almost the luxury of too many to choose from. Mm-hmm. And then we're also looking for things that inevitably happens. This is an example of that. It seems like we end up having the same episode, even though we had a different trigger, because it sort of leads down the same path. And, you know, one of the things I'm reminded of, again, the idea of echoes. History, if it doesn't repeat itself, at least echoes, because there's similarities, and there's tons of ways that you can change U.S. domestic politics in the 70s and 80s. There's more than one way that you can have Watergate be different. This is just one of the ways that it can be different. But each of them has its own little special flair. I mean, would the average American today, here's a good example, be able to give you the name of Gerald Ford? Under this scenario, they might remember him more for playing college football and for being a part of the Warren Commission than they remember him as they do today as a former president.
I think there may be a Ford office building. I think he may have been a successful Speaker of the House, and one of the House office buildings, you know, would be the Ford building.
Yeah. And you know, that's a different, you know, that's a different path, you know, in terms of, you know, sometimes you change history and sometimes history changes you, is the way that I think about it. We've had this conversation a number of times, you know, Brett Frost brought this to conversations we had on podcast and off about, you know, the great figure of history, the great man theory versus the flow of history. And I honestly go back and forth on that depending on what the topic is, because there are individuals that are big enough personalities, they can impact. But it's really hard to swim upstream. It's really hard to change the big flow unless you pick just the right time and just the right place to do it, which is sort of what this is, right?
Or we're kind of in a place where I think a big part of those flows are institutions, kind of what I was saying about earlier. And when institutions start crumbling, that's when great people can come in and really change courses.
Yeah. Whether by challenging the institution, which is sometimes the way that it plays out, or by usurping the institution in some way that's a little bit different, you know, and you know, American institutions were altered. The American political landscape and institutions were altered by Watergate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you remove that, you know, it's just a different thing. Any closing thoughts, Chris?
Two thoughts. First, we need to come up with a new suffix for a political scandal. Because not everything gate? Can be gate anymore.
Not everything can be gate?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because this was called the Chenault Affair, right? We have the XYZ Affair. We may be calling things more affairs as a result of this than gates.
Yeah. Yeah. That's about... The other thing I do want to wish, we do have a Discord fan who's given us an idea. We will get to it. I do want to wish Marco the best luck on your finals. When life settles down, he will probably be joining an episode and joining the cast.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that, Chris, because normally we close out with this. One of the things I've really enjoyed, even in the last month or so, when it's been difficult for me to focus on things podcast because of things life, is I do enjoy interacting with our listeners in the Discord. So if you're not going there, you're not doing that. You know, certainly I welcome you to visit the website, www.aforkintimepodcast.com. But Discord is a place where we can have a two-way conversation, and we have some very avid participants there that are our most notable participants. We get more and more, but what I really enjoy about that is that, you know, they will not just throw out a sentence or two. They will throw out a couple of well-reasoned paragraphs about what's there, and we read those and we respond to them, and I pay more attention to that. Not saying I don't pay attention. I pay more attention to that than the email that I get for if you go to the website and put in a topic suggestion there, because the advantage, I can respond back to that email and maybe another member of the team would respond back too. But when you do it on the Discord server, we all get to jump in. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets fun. And a lot of times I'll realize, oh, I've missed 12 messages there. Well, it wasn't me that responded. You know, Eric Rush jumped in, or Chris jumped in, or somebody else, Dylan jumped in, or whoever it might be, and responded to that. So if you haven't joined us on the Discord server, this is the shameless plug for the Discord server, and going from there. But one of the things we got to get back on pace for is getting enough ahead in our programming queue that the benefits of being a patron for us means that you get the early access to episodes, because that's one of the things that's there. But one of the things that's been added, by the way, for our patrons, that our patrons get now, Christian, may not even be aware of this, is we do have merchandise if you want to tout the show. By the way, we will do an episode of The Room Where It Happened here again at some point, because we have ideas for that too. We just hadn't get around to it. But if you're interested in some Fork in Time merch, one of the things that our patrons get is a discount code that gets them discounts off of that. So you mentioned one particular person now that he's taking advantage of that. So just so it's out there. So if you haven't visited our Patreon page, which you can find the link from the website or in the show notes, you'll find that as well. And I'm just going to say, at the risk of sounding like it broke, go ahead, Chris.
Actually, to bring something back, the last live show we did led to a lot of ideas that wound up in the store.
Yep. And one of the things I've started doing now, I've become, for better or for worse, someone who uses AI a little bit more. So one of the fun things now, I don't do this. So depending on how you access the podcast on your podcatcher of choice, whatever it is, you will see the Fork in Time logo. We don't put custom episode logos there. But if you go to the website, we're starting to use AI to generate some unique images around each of the episodes. And I think that's worth the visit alone. I mentioned sheep suffrage that we'll come back to part two here at some point. ChatGPT did quite a little rendering for that episode that just made me smile and giggle at the same time, if that makes any sense, Chris.
Yeah, no, that was some nice Photoshopping.
Without the Photoshop, which made it even cleaner. But to your point, you know, some of the inspired by stuff you'll find there. You've heard our references to Eric Rush's favorite conspiracy theory, which would be that there is no Wyoming. Mm-hmm. And so if you my daughter, Alexis, actually co-founder of the podcast, still will be back after she's 6 months into being a new mom. And those of you that are moms know exactly what that's about. So mm-hmm. she has all the fun with that. But she owns and has one of the Wyoming inspired by series t-shirts, you know, courtesy of what's there. So, and you also mentioned the other thing there, Chris, we're a little bit behind the timeline we thought we were going to be on, but we have decided for the 200th episode, and we are getting really close, that's going to be another live stream. And our thinking there, I think I mentioned this on the last episode, but if I haven't, I'll mention it here now. Our thinking is to actually do an episode in the live stream that is voted on live by the participants that join the live stream from a list of 4 or 5 topics, and you will decide where we're going that night. We have to do this, sadly, like we do it more often than we'd like to admit. We will do this on the fly for that live stream.
We are probably going to do an episode on Bodie McBoatface.
it could happen. And the cool thing there is, because it'll be the live stream, is our audience will be able to participate in the chat while we're doing that. And I'm curious to see just how that plays out with the whole mm-hmm. team there and, you know, a couple of dozen people interacting from the outside. It's going to get messy, but it's going to be chaotic, but it's going to be fun. I know that's going to be the case. Our listeners will get a better sense for what it's like when we talk off podcast That's when we have a lot of our most fun, because we explore ideas there that we don't put on the stage side of things.
Yeah.
For good reasons. Chris, good to see you. Good to talk to you. I'm going to thank Eric Bond for indirectly suggesting this topic. It's almost like this topic is an echo of his original topic. All right, Chris, we have a suggestion. If our listeners happen upon a fork in time, what do we think they ought to do?
Take it.
See you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Learn more and provide feedback by visiting our website at www.aforkintimepodcast.com. Connect to us on Facebook at facebook.com/aforkintime or follow us on Twitter at AFIT Podcast. If you want to support the show financially, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/aforkintime. We hope you will join us next time.